The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Hello, and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. And one feature of the global economy that's fairly new for anyone under the age of 40 is inflation. I've been talking to the Italian economist Nouriel Roubini, Dr. Doom himself, about the different forces that are driving prices higher in Europe and the US, and what the effort to control inflation will do to the global economy. You can hear that chat in just a few minutes. But first we're going to Italy, a country once again cropping up in conversations about a possible crisis in the Eurozone. Now you don't have to worry, it's not happening yet, but there is a fear that as interest rates go up across Europe, that still very debt-laden economy will find it increasingly difficult to make the sums add up. So it matters to all of us if Italy can't grow fast enough to stay on top of its accumulated debt in the years to come. It's not going to grow much at all if it can't coax more of its people back into work. Here's Bloomberg's economy reporter in Rome, Alessandra Migliaccio.
Il mercato del lavoro in questo momento in Italia è molto complesso.
Italy's job market is currently very complex, and it doesn't easily allow you to return to work once you've exited. This is very discouraging and really quite sad.
That was Beatrice Tarantino. She might sound harmless enough, but the governor of the Bank of Italy believes she represents one of the biggest threats facing the Italian economy. An army of people who neither have a job nor are looking for one. In early March, speaking in front of the country's economic elite in the gold-painted shareholders' hall of the Bank of Italy, Governor Ignazio Visco offered a long list of problems facing his country. But the most bleak was the 2.6 million people available for employment but not searching for jobs. That's more than the actual number of job seekers.
Adequate policies for planning immigration flows, training, and integration are lacking. The labor market participation rate is among the lowest in Europe, especially in southern Italy.
Those figures set Italy apart from all its European peers, even Spain, where there are more unemployed people, but almost all of them are actively seeking work. That means there's huge potential in the economy that isn't being unlocked. It also means productivity could improve, especially in the country's southern regions, where unemployment figures are often double those on the rest of Italy. In that same speech, Governor Visco said the country needs to find solutions, particularly in light of a population that is both aging and shrinking.
Overcoming the factors that hinder productivity growth has become even more necessary, given the demographic projections, which point to a downward trend in the labor force that can only partly be countered by an improvement in the migration balance and by an increase in labor market participation. Most recent projections show that over the next 15 years, the population aged 15 to 64 will fall by 13%, or about 5 million people, half of whom in the south.
Unlocking that jobs potential trapped in the inertia of the Eurozone's third biggest economy is key to Italy's future prosperity. Some of the problem, the governor said, is schooling and a low-skilled labor force. According to Andrea Principe, professor of innovation management and rector of Lewis University in Rome, many people have obsolete skills and are not sure how to retrain themselves. He also believes young people often don't have the right mindset. They need to learn how to learn in order to face a rapidly changing world.
I believe this is not just the usual problem of market and demand. And also, the idea of throwing money at the issue would not address it fully. So my understanding, in fact, my proposal would be to rethink the way we do education, because since the age of people will lengthen, we need to make sure that students and the form people will learn to learn new jobs. So a shift from content to methods to learn new jobs and invent new ones, or at least craft them according to the vagaries of the market.
Adapting to the changing labor market has been a challenge for Beatrice, a 49-year-old who has struggled to find a job since losing hers at an insurance company in Rome during job cuts in 2018. Currently helping a friend with childcare, she says she may try to return to the fray of seeking work later this year.
After the pandemic struck, it got harder to find work at my skill level. And in the end, I ended up helping out a friend with her kids, so I wasn't able to get back into the job market. It's a pity because I have other abilities and think it's a waste of both potential for me, because I have a great desire to work, and for the country.
Millions of people flock to Italy at this time of year to enjoy la dolce vita. Whether it's clothes, the cars, the food, probably no country has done a better job of exporting its culture to the rest of the world. But if it can't find a way to sell its economy to its own citizens, the next few years are going to be bleak indeed. In Rome, I'm Alessandra Migliaccio for Bloomberg News.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
We have a few minutes now to discuss Italy's plight with Rosa Maria Bittetti. She's an economist and lecturer in public policy at Rome's Louis University and an advisor to the OECD. Rosa Maria, thank you very much for joining us. We heard there about the army of people in Italy who are of working age but are not looking for work. Now, as you know, there has been a lot of discussion in the US and in Europe about the so-called Great Resignation. I mean, how much of this Italian problem is related to the COVID pandemic and how much is due to more homegrown issues in Italy?
Thank you, Stephanie, for having me and for discussing this very interesting topic. The Great Resignation wave is something that is happening in Italy, but the problem of high inactivity in the labor market is a long-standing problem and it's quite structural. But if you unpack this very large number in Italy, the most recent data I got from 2019, so well before COVID, and we noticed that the largest percentage, like 38.3%, is people in education. And you will think that a lot of people study in Italy. But then if you then look at variables about tertiary education attainment or PISA results for high school, it's actually not the case. Italians don't obtain more degrees than other countries. It's just that it takes longer. One of the reasons is that school age is later and you finish the legal age of studying after. And also university, the way it's structured, encourages staying more year in education. And so I think there is a structural problem with the education system. The second larger percentage of people who are not actively searching for a job in Italy, it's because of family reason. And it's striking. Italy, I think, is the lowest female labor market participation in Europe. And as a recent mom, discussing with moms as well as a scholar, I realize very deeply that it's strongly related to the fact that welfare in Italy strongly relies on privately family-provided solutions. We have one of the lowest provision of childcare services. So getting a kid, especially if you live in the south of Italy, really kicks you out of the market.
Italy is known for having an aging population, and that obviously affects the workforce directly because you have lots of people retiring. But I guess there's also an indirect effect because there's a lot of old people to look after.
Yes, there are more people to look after. So the elderly who used to help family and still do it a lot in childcare now become part of the responsibilities of families. And that means usually of women that have to require more flexible contracts and take bring less hour into the job market. And that usually makes it much harder for them to find the proper location and find a sustainable job.
You and I have both, even just to negotiate this this meeting, we've both had our family obligations to navigate, so we understand that pretty well. But does the government understand it, and do people like the governor of the Bank of Italy understand that how you could address this need for childcare, it sounds like, more than anything?
So Italy is lacking behind on provision of childcare services. So, and that's especially true in southern part of Italy. And this is for more, let's say, anecdotal discussion and some readings that I have by being a mom and talking with other moms. And even when they can place their kid in childcare, which usually if public close at 4 p.m., that requires them to get a part-time or a quite flexible job. And that's not the HR culture in Italy, getting flexible jobs. And not, I don't think even the COVID pandemic and all the work from home solution has changed that. And also, it's a regulatory issue. We are a country with very high taxes on income. So for somebody who hires a person, hiring a single person or two part-time, it's very different. It's a rigid market with very small firms. So usually part-time jobs are not offered very easily. Even though recent governments have tried to improve the all active labor market services with this centri di collocamento, hiring people to help unemployed people to get jobs, the results are quite striking for their ineffectiveness. So I will tell you this joke. When I was young, my dad told me, you should go and register to the unemployment office. And I was, okay, I mean, I don't really know why, but if you say this is something, I just finished school, I should go there. I went there and I told them about myself. So what's your qualification? And I said, well, I'm an economist. And they were like, I don't know what to do with that. That was... You just write it down. And
I hear that a lot.
So that's how they were. I told them at the end, well, you can say that I can make cake if there's a job opening for like that. So they're very, very ineffective for these kind of jobs.
Well, it sounds like you get a particular perspective as an economist from also living some of these situations. But I know we're going to run out of time because your own child is going to be coming back to the house. So let me just ask you, for people listening, we often talk about, because Italy has so much debt and people are starting to talk about, well, maybe it'll be increasingly difficult for Italy to still service its debt, pay the interest on its debt because interest rates are going up. I don't want to get into all that, but if there's not enough people willing to work who are inactive in Italy, how does that hurt Italy's economic situation and potentially make it harder for the government to deal with higher interest rates? What's the cost for the economy and for growth?
Well, I always think as a GDP, as the income of a family, of a very large family, if my income keeps shrinking, of course, I will not be able to repay my mortgage. So this is pretty much the situation in Italy. But I just want to make one point. I really don't think that Italian people who are inactive don't want to work. I think they are not in the position to work. I think that the Italian economic system is not able to accommodate and give them a job. So they don't even bother registering to the unemployment office. So, because they know that it's not going to be there, and they try informal ways and they don't get there. And this is not sustainable in the long term, because basically you're taking off all this energy and creativity and ability and get stale and cold, and they're not going to be able to contribute to what this country needs to go back to a future of growth. And you know, Italy has been stagnating for decades now, and the only solution is from the people. So we have to find a solution. I think that our political leaders need to find a way to understand what in our institutional framework is letting all this energy and creativity being chained and wasted instead of richly used.
We mentioned it at the end of the piece, because it's an interesting puzzle for people in the rest of the world that if you look, there's so much about Italian culture and food that has taken over the world. You know, our cappuccinos and we aspire to kind of Italian standards of design and the cars and the Dolce Vita, and everyone wants to go there on holiday. And yet somehow the country has not managed to capture the benefits of that global success in all its ideas. Isn't part of this also about companies seeing that potential that you're talking about, that sort of on the sidelines, not able to be playing an active part in the economy? Shouldn't some of these fantastic Italian companies be finding a way to employ these people?
I think that there is definitely a weakness in the industrial infrastructure of Italy, and many firms are too small to be updated, usually family run, so they don't have any real managerial qualification, and that affects growth, of course. But then as policy analysts, you have to step back and ask why Italian firms are not competing anymore, are not growing anymore like they used to do in the 60s and in the boom era. And as you might know, Italy is one of the few countries in which salaries are getting smaller instead of increasing over time. And this is not because each worker is paid less, just because Italian firms used to be on the edge of the frontier of international competition. Now they are shifting to business sector that are less attractive, less innovative, and can provide lower wages. So definitely, I think there's a lacking of entrepreneurial and managerial career and ability to grow. You were making the example of the cappuccino, but the Italian style coffee has been made very popular in the world by Starbucks, not by an Italian company, who then went back to Milan and built a museum of coffee. But that's pretty much it. It's very beautiful to be on vacation, but it seems like cannot be working on her own.
Thank you so much, Rosa Maria. That's been wonderful.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Now, something else that Italy has been quite good at exporting to the rest of the world is economists. Mario Draghi was an export that went home. But Nuno Rubini still roams the world and is probably almost as famous for his gloomy but often prescient analysis of what's going on in the world. I had a conversation with Nuriel, il dottor Destino, at the Qatar Economic Forum the other day. Here are the highlights.
We are seeing and experiencing something we haven't experienced, at least in many of the developed economies, for a long time. Inflation, significant inflation. And we're using a phrase or a word that we haven't used also for a long time, stagflation. So Nuno Rubini, you're not always known for your optimism about the global economy, but listening to an interview you gave this morning, you seem not just long-term gloomy, but short-term gloomy. You think we're headed inevitably for a recession. So I guess my first question to you is a hard landing now inevitable? And if so, when did we go past the point of no return? When did you think, oh, this isn't going to end well?
Well, people like myself were old enough, remember the 1970s, when you had two major oil shocks, the war in 73 between Israel and Arab states, and then in 79, the Islamic Revolution in Iran that led to oil embargoes, spike in oil prices, high inflation, and recession. And I think, unfortunately, this time around, we have both demand factors and supply factors that are causing stagflation and high inflation. On the demand side, of course, we had loose monetary and fiscal policies during COVID, with excess savings that now are leading to pent-up demand. But there were a series of negative supply shocks. First, the impact of COVID, lockdown, reduction of supply of labor, global supply chain problems. But this year, we had also two other negative supply shocks: the brutal Russian invasion of Ukraine, rising energy prices, food, fertilizers, and industrial metals, and now the zero COVID policy of China's leading to slowdown of growth of China and further bottlenecks on the global supply. So we have a situation similar to the 70s, excessive aggregate demand and negative supply shocks. Now, central banks hope that they can raise rates just enough to slow down the economy to bring back inflation to 2%. But the history of the last 40 years suggests that whenever, at least in the US, inflation is above 5%, and right now is 8.5%, and when unemployment is below 5%, right now it's 3.5%, any attempt by the Fed to essentially raise rates to fight inflation causes a hard landing rather than a soft landing. That's why my baseline scenario right now is of a hard landing for the US, for the Eurozone, for the UK, and most advanced economies.
Well, I was going to ask you quickly about that. So as far as you're concerned, the recession that we would see in the US will inevitably be followed by or come with a recession elsewhere?
Well, it's going to be followed by recession elsewhere for two series of reasons. First of all, when the US sneezes, the rest of the world gets a cold. The US is large enough that what happens economically and also in terms of financial markets in the US, that affects the global economy. Two, the same factors that are leading to recession in the US are occurring also in the Eurozone, Europe, and the United Kingdom. If anything, actually, I would say Europe is more exposed to Russia in terms of energy. Europe is more exposed to the slowdown of China, given trade with China. The euro is falling in value, and that's inflationary. And the recovery of Europe was more anemic than the United States. So in some sense, Europe, Eurozone, and UK are as fragile, if not more fragile, than the United States.
We have some understanding about what the Fed's going to do, but would you say that Europe potentially has more or less room in terms of the central bank response? I mean, they don't face the same kind of demand issue.
Well, in terms of levels of inflation rates, the levels in the Eurozone right now are as high as the United States. In the UK, it's even worse than that. Among advanced economies, the only one that has much lower inflation is still Japan. That explains why the BOJ policy is very different. And it's true that the nature of inflation in Europe might be slightly different. More exposure to energy in Russia, more of headline inflation rather than core because of that, slightly less strong wage dynamics, more supply shocks rather than aggregate demand shocks. But in a world where you have this stagflationary shock, whether you're the Fed, the ECB, the BOA, SMB, RBA, or you name it, you are in trouble because whenever you have these stagflationary shocks, inflation is higher, growth is lower. If you care about inflation and not the anchoring inflation expectation, you have to exit and normalize sooner and faster, but that increases the risk of a hard landing. And if instead you care also about economic growth and you normalize more slowly, then the risk is that you're going to have a de-anchoring of inflation expectation. And whether the shock is supply or demand, in some sense, doesn't matter. Even in the presence of a supply shock, like we learned from the 70s, if you don't fight inflation, inflation expectation get de-anchored, and you end up with stagflation, not just with inflation, but also recession. And I would say the ECB is as much in a pickle as the Fed, given the exposure to Russia, given the exposure to China, given the more dynamic recovery, given that the euro is falling in value, and therefore you're going to have more imported inflation. So the problems are similar.
And when you think about the sort of global knock-on effects of this, or we would call the spillovers, we had years after the global financial crisis where we talked about currency wars, and the game in currency wars was to depreciate your currency and try and import some inflation because inflation was too low. What's the risk now, or how much are we already seeing the reverse of that, a stronger the US in effect trying to export inflation through a stronger dollar?
Yeah, a stronger dollar implies that inflation is higher in Europe, is inflation is higher in other advanced economies, but more importantly, inflation is also much higher in emerging markets. We've spoken about advanced economies, but in some sense, the situation of emerging markets is more difficult. Of course, you have to make a caveat. There are some emerging markets that are energy and or commodity exporters. Those are doing well, like in the region. There are some emerging markets that have stronger macroeconomic fundamentals with lower inflation. But, you know, the typical EM that is net commodity importer now is facing raising rates in the United States with weakening of their currencies that leads to higher inflation and with higher borrowing costs. It has a terms of trade shock because especially in Asia, but also in many other emerging markets, they are net commodity importers. And for them, the rise in energy, food, fertilizer, industrial metal is a major economic shock. Of course, if you are in very poor countries, you get to the point in which they have to worry about hunger, if not famines, like in sub-Saharan Africa. And the third shock for emerging markets is this slowdown of China that is now significantly also affecting negatively, especially economic growth in Asia, that is connected to the global supply chains of China. So you got the Fed shock, you get the dollar shock, you get the terms of trade shock, you get the China shock. So that's why folks at the World Bank and IMF say for many emerging markets or poor countries, this is not a COVID recession, it's a near depression that they have to worry about.
Now, Nuria, we're going to run out of time, but you have spoken quite a lot about crypto in the past. And I was interested, given it's been a pretty turbulent ride for a lot of the cryptocurrencies in the last few months, how are you looking at the... Is it the future? Was it a fad, or is it the future, or are you changing your view?
Well, from the peak of last November, Bitcoin has lost about 70% of its value. Other cryptocurrencies have lost 80 to 90% of them. You know, the study suggests that 90% of all ICOs were scams of one sort or another. I think, however, the most important point is that calling cryptocurrencies currencies is a misnomer. Anybody who knows about monetary theory and policy, like His Excellency, knows that for something to be a money or a currency, it has to be unit of account. Nothing is the price in Bitcoin. It has to be a scalable a means of payment. With Bitcoin, you can do 7 transactions per second. With the Visa network, you can make 50,000. It has to be a stable store of value. Here you have an asset that can go up and down in value overnight by 10, 20%. Not even crypto conferences accept Bitcoin as a means of payment or a store of value. And it has to be a single numerator so you can price the relative price of goods and services. If every good and service is a different token, it's like going back to barter. You cannot even see the relative price. So calling them currencies is really a misnomer.
But if it was a misunderstanding, what's happened in the last few months? Will people come to their senses, do you think?
Well, there was a huge bubble. There was a fear of missing out. There were Ponzi schemes. Many people bought at their peak, and now they've lost a fortune, whether in cryptocurrency, crypto assets, DeFi, and so on. I think that in this space, if you want stuff that is going to be not vaporware, you need to find asset-backed tokens of one sort or another that are backed by real assets or financial assets. Otherwise, those that are based on essentially vaporware are going to be disappearing over time.
I hesitate to ask this final question to you, Nuriel, but I was looking at my notes, and the last time we spoke, which was more or less in the middle of COVID, you were predicting that there would be some inflation coming out of COVID that would cause policy mistakes, and you would then have a 10-year depression in most of the world economy, give or take. Are we more or less on course for that, or can we expect something slightly better?
Mm-hmm. I certainly worry about stagflation in the short run, but I think that the factors that might lead into mediocre growth are not just short-term. If you look at medium-term, there are a whole series of other negative supply shocks. We have deglobalization and protectionism. We have reshoring of manufacturing from low cost to high cost. You have aging of populations. You have restriction to migration. You have this decoupling between US and China. You have global climate change. In many channels, is stagflationary, reducing growth and increasing cost of production. You have, unfortunately, recurrent pandemics. You have cyber warfare. You have a backlash against income and wealth inequality. You have the weaponization of the US dollar. These are all factors that are not short-term, that over time may reduce growth, increase cost of production, and being stagflationary. So unless we address this issue, we could end up not with a mild recession, but something more like a depression with inflation, meaning a deeper stagflationary debt crisis, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Doom, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for this episode of Stephanomics. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, do please rate the show if you like it. And check out the Bloomberg News website for more economic news and views on the global economy. You can also follow @economics on Twitter. This episode was produced by Summer Sadi and Young Young, with special thanks to Nouriel Roubini, the Qatar Economic Forum, Rosa Maria Bittetti, and Alessandra Migliaccio. Mike Sasso is the executive producer of Stephanomics.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.